the Gaming Guru Podcast. Easily the best gaming podcast in the world. Guru Baby.
And here we go again. Another week has passed, and let's chat gaming. Welcome, Tim.
What's up? What's up? How's it going?
Yeah, good, man. It's been an interesting week. We've had a lot of public holidays, and so lots of gaps in the routine, and certainly maybe a little bit more hours to play some games.
Huge.
What have you got for us? What's in the news at the moment?
So the news, we're looking at, sadly, loot boxes again. There's a new US bill targeting loot boxes and pay-to-win microtransactions brought forward by Senator Josh Hawley to ban loot boxes and microtransactions in games played by minors. It's called the Protecting Children from Abusive Games Act.
Okay, cool. Stoked that people are standing up against loot boxes. Why do only the children get protection?
It's all about the children, right?
Yeah, like, I get it, because they're going, it's gambling and gambling are bad, and so, like, we need to not have gambling.
Okay. Yeah, totally.
But it's also one of those, why didn't we just ban loot boxes? Because they're a shitty idea that ruins games.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it comes down to the motivations of Congress at this point. Like, whenever you have, I guess, an unchecked side of the market, and let's face it, like, the gaming industry has really kind of gotten a free pass on a lot of things in a lot of areas, and, you know, gambling mechanics in their games is only just one of them. You know, these things go way back also into the treatment of developers, of their staff. You see massive layovers, and, you know, not paying taxes has also come out in the last couple of months. So I think this is kind of one of the first, not the first step, but it's one of the first sort of bills. I think at this point, it's about the third bill coming from Congress in the United States in the last 2 years, which is, like, quite a lot in a very short space of
time,
targeting this specific thing. So I do think that at some point, one of these bills is going to get through. And if it doesn't, it's going to create more legwork for the next one to build on. It's just something for people to campaign on. And at the end of the day, like, who wants kids gambling?
Yeah, I hear you. I guess my only counter is, so it's people who bitch about DLC, people who bitch about microtransactions, people who bitch about loot boxes. The only counter, and I hate a lot of those things, I'm pro DLC, I'm against the other two. My concern is that people don't realize that the escalating price of games, for games to be as cutting edge and as competitive with Hollywood in terms of their production values, they are massive staffs of international people, you know, flying across the world to go to these, like, huge studios. That people make a living, and they cost money, and it's hundreds and, you know, sometimes thousands of people making games, not dozens as it used to be. And yet the price of games has stayed the same. It is in fact, I saw a thing where games have gone from, like, $50 to $60 over the last 10 years. But if you factor in for inflation, they've actually decreased in price, because $60 is not worth what $50 was. And so, yeah, we get hurt a bit by the exchange rate. We've discussed this before. But I think what people don't realize is, if you take away all these other ways for studios to make money, then you get to a point where you're going, cool, we've now reached the point where you have to just increase the price. Like, it's the only way we can make these profitable. Or what happens is we have to overwork people, which is already happening.
Yeah.
Or you have to salary people and underpay them and overwork them. Or the minute a game is bad, does poorly, we have to, like, sack thousands of people because we can't afford to develop the next one. So it's a risky game we play as consumers to just demand everything for free, and the price can't go up ever. It's just...
Look, I mean, the counter to that would be, like, there's no doubt that video game production is more expensive now than it ever has been. And it really is an important sort of marker to check off when it comes to developing games. You know, how will this be monetized in the future, and where will we see, you know, our returns coming from? At the same time, you know, we've seen time and time again in the media that these profits are not getting to the people on the ground. In fact, the people on the ground are the ones getting sacked. And you just have, like, the Bobby Kotick's of the world just racking up more and more millions, being on, I guess, what Forbes, like, kind of top 100 highest paid people in the world, worth about $4 billion at the moment. You know, and that's at Activision, right? So it's, and, you know, after all those record-breaking profits, you still have them laying off, like, 10% of their staff. to keep the investors happy, to keep those profit margins and the stocks at like a certain curve. Mm. So I don't necessarily think the two correlate. It's one thing to say we need a way to further monetize this game in order to, you know, hold that same standard of production. But then what we're seeing in, you know, at the same time is like, it's not really going to where it's meant to be going. And this comes down to, let's say, Gearbox, for instance. I think a lot of their staff are paid slightly less than market standards, but they're also, what they're given in exchange for that is company equity.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, shares. Yeah.
Like in big old quotation marks, because we don't know what those things are worth. We don't know how those pay out or how it turns out. All we know is they are paid less.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually been news. It's ironic enough that you're talking about Gearbox, because old Randy's been in the news again.
Oh, jeez, Lord.
Because of now the voice of Claptrap, if I remember correctly, he's basically said that, you know, A, I've been fired, and B, I wasn't paid or compensated properly for the previous two games.
Yeah, so So Randy Pitchford, you know, tends to shoot from the hip. He tends to cause a lot of the major tidal waves as far as like negative press goes for Gearbox and 2K Gaming. Sort of started last week with Borderlands 3 when he announced via his live stream there'll be no microtransactions game, no loot boxes, and obviously they're skins. So Game Informer reported on this saying, contrary to what Randy Pitchford would have you believe, there actually are skins for sale in this game. And here's a quote from him in his response: "Why you guys would fuck me on this is beyond me." So it's just the kind of language that Oak uses,
isn't the kind of like boredom
language that you'd hear. But in that same thread, one of the fans asked at David Eddings if he'd be reprising his role as Claptrap for Borderlands 3, and he responded saying no. Gearbox had reached out to him, and when he gave them his performance fee, they said they couldn't afford him. His response to that was, well, you know, maybe if you put that, you know, the $12 million from 2K Games into the Gearbox account, you instead of Randy Pitchford's personal account, you might have the cash to pay for talent. And so Randy responded to this quite harshly, actually, basically just tearing down David Eddings, saying, look, this guy's bitter.
Yeah, like whiny, you
know,
he
enjoyed the attention. He reveled in it, you know, and we paid him handsomely. He was paid really well when he was with us. Mm. And David Eddings responded saying, just to clear the air, I wasn't going to actually bring this up, but since my former employer came and openly attacked me on a public forum, I have to defend myself, basically saying that the first two performances he did for Borderlands 1 and 2, he did for free. When they approached him about performing Claptrap's voice for the third game, he said originally that he would do it for free. In exchange, he asked for royalties owed from his first two performances in Borderlands 1 and 2, and then a public apology letter from Randy Pitchford, basically apologizing for assaulting him at Games Convention.
Oh, brilliant.
So, I mean, like, this is just...
So, basically, pay me for stuff that it's already done well and paid for itself.
Yeah.
And say sorry for something that I could basically take you to court for.
Yeah. And after that, I mean, he further embellished in that, basically saying that his relationship with Randy has been rocky, to say the least. The guy stalked him on social media for some time. He's had fights with him. And literally, a big part of him leaving the company was because he just could not work with this guy anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he felt like, you know, it would be cool to come back and voice Claptrap for the third one, you know, like collab with his friends over at Gearbox. But I guess the guy just makes it very difficult to work.
Yeah, sounds like a real piece of work.
Yeah, it does.
What else you got for us news-wise?
News-wise, that's about it for me from the news bites.
What are you playing at the moment?
I'm actually revisiting God of War. When I played it the first time last year, I breezed through it really quickly for like review purposes. And it's been sitting on my shelf, and once I kind of got Red Dead Redemption like off...
off your chest.
Off my chest, out of my PlayStation and, you know, out of my life, I decided to put that back in and just give it another whirl, because it's really... It's one of those games that like kind of grabbed my attention from start to finish. I never felt like... You know, I never felt bored in it, always felt detained, always felt like I was getting to know these characters better, seeing different sides of them, and
Well, it's game of the year for a reason last year.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, that really got me thinking about open world games and sort of fatigue, because I compare it to, let's say, some of the other games that I played towards the end of last year, like Spider-Man, for instance, which, you know, hands down, brilliant game. A lot of my friends went through and got the platinum for it. But I felt like I didn't necessarily want to sit and like tick a bunch of check boxes in each location. I just got bored, man.
Yeah. Well, I hear you with the platinum thing. So I am one of those who, you know, slogged down and got the platinum for Spider-Man. But I have to say, maybe the last hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, was tick boxing. You are flying around the city in certain areas going, okay, I need to get like one more backpack here and three street crimes. And like, oh yes, a street crime's happening. And then you solve it within 30 seconds. And then, okay, it's the next one. Where is it? You just zoom around basically running errands just so you can get the little, you know, platinum pop-up. And yeah, I think there's a certain level of padding that goes into a lot of these open world games, because, I mean, we were chatting off air a little bit about the value proposition that some games try to sell you, and it's getting to that point, I think, with gaming being an expensive hobby where people equate it. They'll go, I remember last year when guys were arguing about which is game of the year, and I think the only two games that really were contenders, maybe the outside contender was Spider-Man, but the two main contenders was Red Dead and God of War.
Yeah.
And one of the major arguments people were having for why Red Dead should be game of the year was they were saying that, you know, it's over 100 hours of gameplay and God of War is only about 20, 25 hours. You're going, okay, so when did game length even come into consideration in terms of the quality of the game? Mm. And look, it only stems from, let's be honest, an idea of value for money.
Yes.
But that shouldn't have any indication in terms of the decision from a creative aspect as to whether something is good or not. I mean, imagine a movie going, well, this has only got an hour and 10 minutes runtime, so it can't possibly win versus Endgame, which is over 3 hours. It's like, totally. No, that's not how it works. Is it entertaining or not?
Yeah, and I think there was a tool that popped up online last year, which actually, when you search the game name, I wish I could throw out the name of the tool now, but it just escaped me. It'll tell you how many, like, you know, average hours of gameplay, and a lot of people will look at that and use it as a measure of, you know, am I getting my bang for buck?
This is 1,000 rand, and I get 100 hours, so that's better. Yeah, am I getting bang for buck? It's 500. That's
And it's interesting that the sort of landscape is shifting this way, you know, because we look at games like, let's say, what Naughty Dog produced, which are very much cinematically driven story experiences that you could, you know, easily clock in like under 20 hours compared to, let's say, like a Red Dead Redemption 2 at the moment, where, you know, you'll be putting like a good like 4 or 5 months of your of your life down into this thing, right? And whether and how good that game did back then and how it might fare in, like, let's say, if it came out in 2019, for instance.
Well, I mean, a case in point would be, for example, Days Gone, which, you know, I've been playing, I've been enjoying. It's open world with the storyline that's kind of driving it, but there's a lot of errand, you know, running and all this stuff. And it's one of those things where you go, have we reached a point where we've just kind of fatigued by open world games? Like, we see through the padding. I don't know if it's because, you know, it feels like gone are the days where people are only playing one game. You know, like, it used to be a kind of...
Gone are the days gone.
Yeah, gone are the days gone. Where you're only playing one game and therefore you're fully invested in the story. Yeah. Guys are... I mean, if I take myself, for example, I'm playing a game that I'm doing that I enjoy. At the same time, there's a game that I'm probably reviewing. And on top of that, there's the game that I'm doing as an esports type thing. So I'll often, between playing Days Gone, I'm still then grinding Mortal Kombat because I'm enjoying playing it. But then if my mates are playing Dota, I'll jump into a game of Dota or Fortnite or Apex, because, like, it's kind of what you do. So that you've kind of got those games that you're always going back to. So for a lot of people, it's Apex and Fortnite and CSGO and COD and all that. And then whatever game that they are playing. And so value for money is becoming less important in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because they're going like, I can just go back to my free game that I was playing. This is my, like, I want to have fun hobby thing. And so don't pad my games with stuff that starts feeling like a chore.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it comes back down to, let's say, the development timeline and sort of like game development focus. We know that a big sort of driving factor in the industry at the moment is that live service model and feature monetization options are the different ways of going about it. You can create a scenario that that player or game loop that players can keep themselves in, let's say like a Fortnite or a Dota or an Apex, where it's, you know, same map, different players, you have a good time, and you're in that economy for the next couple of hours.
Yeah.
And you know, compare it to, let's say, what is going on over on Ubisoft's side, where every game is an open world, because the bigger the world, the longer they're going to be there, the more time you have to market at them.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, if you go back to your analogy of value for money, a lot of those games that people are jumping back into are free.
Yeah.
You know, they make their money from skins and all that, but I haven't spent a cent on Apex.
Yeah.
Like, I spent a little bit of cash on Fortnite and a lot of cash on Dota. But it's one of those things, like, you can just keep going back to that game for free. So it becomes difficult to, you know, warrant, you know, from a value for money point of view, spending hundreds of hours in a game that costs money when you can do the same in a game that's free. I think, interestingly enough, when you talked about that gameplay loop, I think people are also cottoning onto the fact that even though it's an open world game, there's still a gameplay loop.
Yes.
People, I think, have been, when open worlds were novel, because it feels like a pendulum that swung. We've gone from being used to linear games, like there was a story and that's how the game worked and replayability was limited. We want an open world game where we can solve problems the way we want to solve them.
Yeah.
But you don't realize that there's still a gameplay loop.
Yes.
Sometimes, in fact, the open worldness, like, becomes arbitrary because they lock certain things between arbitrary gates, like you don't have the skill to jump over that hay bale. And so now all of a sudden, instead of being open world, that hay bale becomes like this insurmountable river because you don't have the skill to jump, you know, and so it becomes really arbitrary. You know, it's like once you've defeated the boss that teaches you how to jump, then you can go over that hay bale back in the opening world. It's like, it's not really open world, it's just gated in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about that pendulum that you mentioned, it's a good analogy, because, you know, when I think about game development, let's say the average game development cycle is what, like 4 to 5 years or so?
Yeah, for your AAA.
So we can safely say that a lot of these games that are coming out now that we're playing were pitched into pre-production like 4 or 5 years ago, in like 2014, 2015. You know, we started seeing those roll over, you know, in 2016, when you had, like, you know, Breath of the Wild, you know, coming out, you had Horizon Zero Dawn, like these really great open world games, and, you know, also GTA 5.
Yeah.
And now we've sort of gotten to a point where the market's almost saturated, but these things are like hitting the deadlines now.
Yeah.
And they're coming out. They've been in development
now. Open world was exactly a key factor in the design.
Exactly. So now I just feel like the market's flooded, and it's kind of like it's affected the way that I enjoyed Spider-Man. It's after playing all of Red Dead Redemption 2, I can't.
Yeah.
I was so done here. I was like, you know, amazing game, brilliant game, deserves all the awards it got, deserves its Metacritic score. And you can forgive any of the jankiness of the controls just because of the sort of, let's say, artistic feat that it achieved, right? You know, but at the same time, it's made me want to go back to something simpler.
Okay.
Like, I can't look at another open world game for a while. I need time.
What scares me sometimes as a reviewer is when you'll hear things like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, for example, and they'll go, oh, it's like 15 to 20 hours before you even get into the main story. I'm like, I don't have time for that. I have 20 hours before I get into the main story, and then another 80 to finish the game, and then, oh, that's like the female character. Now you gotta do the male character if you want to see the whole thing.
Fuck,
like,
off.
No,
fuck,
sorry, right, like, I don't have time. Ain't nobody got time for that. I need to be able to get into the core of the game, see enough of the story that I can give a review of it, but without the expectation that I need to finish and see every ounce of the game.
It's difficult for reviewers, because now I think more and more developers are basically giving mandates on how many hours you just spend the game first before you can you can give your review.
A lot of them will check that you've done at least, it's usually about 15 hours in the game before you can give a review, because a lot of them will say you haven't fully experienced the game until
you've
seen X happen or Y happen, and it does make it difficult. But it feels like open world became like a checkbox type thing. You're going, cool, you're going to design the perfect game, right, let's start. First of all, it needs to, you might go, what's the genre to pick? I would say it needs to be a puzzle game, a first-person shooter, or a battle royale. Those make money. Okay, cool. Or third-person action adventure. Don't do a point-and-click adventure. Don't do, like, any of those kind of simulator type games. Those don't make money compared to these. So you're going to pick one of those. Then you're going to go, okay, cool. Now it needs to have open world. Yes, everyone wants open world. And it's just one of those things that feels like it's part of the structure. Like if you ask someone on the street, hey, we're designing a game. Would you like a linear game or an open world game? Linear instantly has this connotation of like on rails, boring, only play through once. Open world has this idea, like these connotations of do whatever you want, the world's alive and all that. And unfortunately, open world is maybe a design style, but there's still certain elements that need to be in it for it to be good.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, I was looking at Days Gone at some of the reviews and getting a lot of mixed reviews. Mm. And I just think that had this game come out like 3 years ago, it might have been doing better than it is now. I don't think it's a bad game by any stretch of the means. I think it's, you know, one could argue that, you know, some of the controls are a bit janky, but no less janky than like Red Dead Redemption 2, who has to give you bullet time just to be able to fucking aim at something because the gun mechanics are so shit.
Bad,
you know, and it comes down to like, is the gaming industry as a whole feeling this fatigue, and is that now affecting the performance of a game like Days Gone?
Yeah, perhaps it might be a case of just we are tired of open world games. It's one of those difficult things as well in an open world game where your reason to want to be in that world is difficult. So I remember the one where it really hit me like a ton of bricks was having to review Far Cry Primal.
Mm.
And you're going, cool, you're thrown into this world with saber-toothed tigers and mammoths and all that sort of stuff. But your character's reason to even start is going, you're on a hunt and you fall down the like a side of a cliff and you're separated from your brother and the rest of the tribe.
Yeah.
Now you need to rejoin them. I'm like, I'm sorry, it's just not enough of a incentive to start the game. You know, I think of other open worlds that like really see you into it, like Skyrim.
Yeah.
You're on the back of this wagon, what the hell's going on? Oh, it finds out you're about to be executed, and literally as the hangman's about to, or the execution's about to drop the axe on you, a dragon swings by.
Dude, spoilers, what the shit?
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, man.
It's actually been out on every single console and mobile and everything for a couple of years now.
70
times. Sorry, spoiler alert. And then you're instantly given a choice of like, follow this guy who was part of like the jailbreak dudes, or follow the guys that were part of the execution crew. It's like, instantly pick a side.
Instantly
it's,
making choices, yeah.
Meanwhile, and if you don't make a decision, a dragon's tearing the place up. Like,
yeah.
there's already this reason to get involved. And then you're down this path and what's going on and all that sort of stuff. So I think part of it really for me is a reason to get involved.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is, for me, it feels like the world must exist without you.
Yes.
You know, I hate some of these games where it legitimately feels, and I'm going to pull an Assassin's Creed on this one for ones that don't do it as well. It feels in Assassin's Creed like everyone is sitting around waiting for you to arrive and start a conversation with them. And yeah, they're like, in the background, there's...
Bayek, yeah, how you been, mate?
Yeah, there's music and they're making sound effects and the goats are running around or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's weird. It doesn't feel like the town or the cities are alive. It feels like they're sitting there in their little like loop. This guy walks 2 blocks and comes back 2 blocks and walks 2 blocks and comes back waiting for you to bump into him. He goes, oh, why did you do that? Like, with some of the games, like you go, GTA was a classic example, or Breath of the Wild, where it felt like stuff's going on without you. Like, it's not to use an analogy, it's not like a matrix with one person where all the people, other people are loaded in and unloaded as like a draw distance. They arrive when you're there. It feels like if you decided in your personal matrix to go to sleep today, all the other characters are still going about their lives. It's not like, oh, well, the one decided to sleep in today, so we don't have to use that memory. We're not going to load in today. The world still exists and progresses without you.
Yeah, like if you're in Novigrad and a tree falls in Velen, like, does the tree exist?
Yeah, exactly. Is that actually happening? Why is it low time so long? Well, do you know that there's a tree falling in the city like 10,000 kilometers away?
You know, and that's a good example of, let's say, open world done in a compelling way and done in a boring way. Like, let's say, so when I first jumped into Assassin's Creed Origins, so I didn't play Odyssey because of what I'd heard, you know, and I felt like a lot of the assets that were used in Origins were probably used in Odyssey as well. You know, you have this massive, massive open world, but you start to lose the identity of certain areas because, you know, they're reusing certain buildings, certain assets,
and everything looks the same.
The initial like wow of seeing how beautiful this world looks just slowly like disintegrates as you become more desensitized to the general style of everything that you look at. And then when I compare that to, let's say, a game that I would say arguably does open worlds really great would be like, let's say, Witcher 3 or Horizon Zero Dawn, where you have different regions that have completely different sort of visual styles, you know, different music, different character styles, accents even, you know, where a story arc kind of generally goes from start to finish in that region and you move on before you become too bored of it. Yeah, you can come back for the other nitty-gritty, but you're moving on, you're moving around. It feels like the world is changing around you. And the characters will tell you when you're coming through, you know, that that their lives were shit before you got there and they'll be shit afterwards when you leave.
Yeah.
You know, it really feels like a place that you're passing through and life was happening there. You often stumble into people's problems, you know, as they're happening. Same goes for Horizon Zero Dawn, where you have these three different tribes in these different regions that look completely different. You know, you got your jungle region, you got your desert region, then you have
snowy
and you have the snow. So it creates identity, it creates it really adds to the lore and makes the world feel lived in, and it gives you something to connect to and draw from while you're moving through it, even if that happens over like a 100-hour period.
Well, you know, you talk about assets being reused and how you start losing the almost the authenticity of the different regions. I think games like GTA do really well in that, where you go, once you play that game for about 10 hours, you know, down this street, you know, take the map, left, man. And then like, oh, it's that yellow building, go there, and that's where the Kluckenbell is, and you go, and you know where things are. And it's a case of going, it doesn't feel like, oh, is it the fourth Kluckenbell or the fifth, or like how many times? It's like you know all the different areas. And then it feels like, as you go into the rich areas, the people are dressed differently and the cars are different, or the spawn rates of the
Lamborghinis. The dialogue, they say like different things.
Narnia things, exactly. Like, whereas you go into certain other areas, all of a sudden, like, it's more jeeps and rugged kind of off-terrain vehicles on it, because now we're out in the sticks in the mountains sort of thing. So things change, it feels like, organically. And it's not a case of going, even though obviously this is happening, the assets load in as you arrive, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like almost like the side missions would expire if you didn't do them when they are needed, because heck, that's what real life's like.
Yeah,
you know, we have obviously our narrative, our story, our purpose, whatever, we all have to get all philosophical, but then you've got these side missions that happen all the time. Like you've got these things of like, this needs to happen by this date. If you don't do it, it expires, you know. It's not like a case of going, oh, I can always just go back to that character and they're sitting there waiting with the yellow exclamation mark above them, and then they go, wow, I'm so glad you just got here because the house is on fire and has been burning for a week, but you decided to only do the side quest now.
But I mean, the reason why I kind of like got into this topic was because, you know, revisiting God of War, it got me thinking on, you know, how Corey Barlog and his team sort of put together elements of open world and kind of blended it so seamlessly with the sort of on-rail experience that's really great for storytelling, you know, character development, and taking you through like specific moments, you know, where they give you enough of a world to play with and explore, where you feel like this is a world that I can explore if I want to. You know, when you're on those rails in, let's say, Last of Us, for instance, and you look over a bush and you see, you know, the mountains behind you, like, you can't fucking go there.
No, you can't.
You know,
that's
You know, and that's why I do think that Naughty Dog is going to probably bring these elements of, you know, slight open world hubs into Last of Us Part 2, the same way they did in Uncharted Lost Legacy.
Okay.
Which had that sort
of like... Yeah, that did quite well.
Yeah.
I think for me, the key though is the main story is the main story.
Yes.
And the side quests need to complement that story, because sometimes they're just random. And I hate that when it's like, collect 12 birds' eggs. And like, what's this got to do with the story in any way, you know? But the one thing I struggle most with is when side quests don't play into the urgency of the main quest. And I think two, for example, the one would be Batman, I think it was Arkham City, Arkham Knight, the latest one, where I think the Scarecrow or something has got the whole city, you know, of Gotham hostage, and he's about to release the fear gas that's going to basically blanket the entire town and cause riots. And he says, it's going to be happening soon, you better hurry and get there. But there's always that open world stuff you can do, like solve like the Riddler puzzles, or like do these weird Batmobile tank shootout sort of thing. And so you're going, Wait, so now I've done, because I'm in an area that's got a lot of Riddler puzzles, I've done like 4 hours of Riddler puzzles, and what the scarecrow's just waiting, he's going, hey there, man, like, sorry, it's me again.
Just checking in, see what's up.
So I'm going to leave a voicemail. I don't know if you get these, I know a lot of people don't read their voicemails. It's SC Scarecrow, yeah, just wondering what's up. Just
thinking about you.
Yeah, at the normal place. Okay, bye. Beep. It's just like, it really removes from it. And the other one that's just as bad was with Tomb Raider, where you've got, I'm going to call them Nazis, but they're not Nazis, whatever, the futuristic version of some Nazi Illuminati type organization. They're literally on the doorstep of getting this weird ancient artifact that's going to destroy the world and you've been hunting for and everything. But if you get rid of all these bears in this cave, this ancient civilization will give you this sniper rifle that they found. It's like, no, like, cool, I hate bears as much as the next person. I also want that sweet-ass sniper rifle, which somehow this ancient civilization is going to give me.
It's been hanging on to.
But the main story is the Nazis. Like, you must want to go. There are certain time-sensitive quests that all of a sudden put you back on rails.
Yeah.
Where they go, cool, you're open-worlding and you're doing your thing, but at this point, time is of the essence. And so put a counter, even if it breaks the little, the engagement by putting a counter in the HUD so you can see it's 20 minutes left, whatever.
I actually like counters in games.
Yeah, put a little bit of urgency on it.
You know, It reminds me of how I felt playing Res 2, where just having that level of stress of not exactly a counter, but having that guy, you know, chase you around the building just made you play differently. So it makes you play differently. So when it comes to open world games that are successful for me, you know, what is the appeal of the open world game? It's player choice, right? I can go anywhere, I can do anything. Yeah. You know, we've had different ways of like kind of gating players from different areas so they don't go into some place they're not supposed to go to first. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the order in which they want players to experience the open world, right? Narratively. But then with that, player choice has to matter. You know, when I choose like these pants over those pants when I go out for the day, like that's a conscious choice that I made. It needs to matter. Yeah. It needs to matter in the game as well. And that's where, you know, I think games like The Witcher have really kind of hit that bar where you feel like your actions and your choices have consequences. And that's what I found was really lacking when it came to, let's say, Assassin's Creed Origins, which I heard they changed for Odyssey. But at that point, I was already fatigued by the franchise. I was like, I don't really want to go into ancient Greece for another like 100 hours. Yeah. Like, I don't. Like, I've done it. But when I was in that world in Origins, I felt like the story was happening to me. I wasn't happening to it.
Yeah, okay. No, fair enough. I think player choice, you know, is obviously a key element of why people want to play open world games. I mean, you even goes open world as Minecraft, where you go, the world is yours. Like, literally do whatever you want. Gating of certain areas, I just struggle when it becomes arbitrary. I mean, I used the hay bale example earlier. I think games that have done it quite well are, I hate the, you have to find a certain piece of tech to unlock a certain area, unless there's a relevant reason why. Like, if you want to use a Batman thing, for example, where, you know, it's been stolen from you and you need to, like, regain it, that's one way. But the way Batman did it was they're going, you got to a certain area and then you couldn't get it, and then you got to a certain part in the story and he would just call in the, like, a drop from Alfred, would just, like, the bat.
Yeah, that's, the bat wing that's a bit
drop,
lazy.
Drop it off.
You go, like, why couldn't you give this to me ages ago, though?
Exactly. Like, what are you doing, Alfred, that you couldn't have done it to
it
me?
It was in my other pants, so.
And so, you like, that for me is arbitrary. I like where you defeat a certain boss and a piece of tech that he has. Like, for example, say you need some sort of key code or whatever sort of thing, and it's actually a legitimate, like, you don't have this key card to get through a certain area. Defeating a boss that had it, now you suddenly have it and you unlock all those doors that were hidden behind that. Some guys do it through difficulty gating. So I know, like, Witcher, for example, if you went to Skellige too early, everything was way too strong for you. Like,
yeah, it would just smash you.
And so, you know, some people might say that's arbitrary, because, like, what makes this area more difficult, what makes the beast in this area hard?
High level,
like,
dude, damn.
Just deal with it. Like, it's like if you go to certain areas of the world, it's just rougher there.
That's why I don't go to yours truly. It's just everyone's high level than me.
And so, I suppose then it's like a social status thing. But Far Cry New Dawn tried something now, where you had enemies of a certain tier.
Yes.
And if your weapons weren't that tier, then you did like abysmal damage. It's the kind of thing like, and it broke the game a little bit for me, I have to be honest, where you're going, you go to a level 3 area and you see a guy that you want a headshot because you're trying to clear out the region, and you headshot him with your level 1 rifle that still shoots metal bullets. You know, they might not be the strongest, but they are still shards of metal flying at the human skull. And his armor is a balaclava.
And he's like, hey, dude, I'm level 3 balaclava.
Yeah, here, and that's the thing. And then what happens is you just alert him because he's like, ah, oh, a pee, hit me in the face. And so he alerts the whole place. And then you just swarm by other level 3 guys. And so basically you can't even hope to fight those areas unless you're level 3 yourself. And so that feels a little bit arbitrary because, like, it's still a gun, it still shoots metal, and the human face is still the human face. Like,
yeah, that was there was an interesting thing about story around Red Dead, actually, the way they gated you away from riding into Blackwater before the end of the game.
Okay.
They just, I guess, had swarms of enemies come at you.
Yeah.
So you just couldn't really fight your way through. A lot of people had tried to get through, and the game just makes it impossible.
Yeah, which you can do a lot easier in a linear game because you're like, there's almost skill checks. You can't go further till you've beaten this boss.
Yeah.
And I think with the mix a little bit is sometimes it's games like Sekiro or the Dark Souls games where they're kind of open world, and the fact that you can go about it in different areas.
Yeah.
But there are certainly, you know, there's a progression style that you can that you can go through. And you almost feel like certain bosses become skill checks. Going,
yes.
We don't want you to go to the other areas because you will legitimately get your shit mixed unless you can beat this boss.
Yeah.
Because this boss checks particularly the skill of like parrying. And when you get into the next area, if you can't parry yet, you're not going to have a good time. You know, so it's one of those like almost skill checking things.
And I mean, that's, you know, these skill checks and let's say locked of zones, we could say that God of War is also a good example of that because the game gives you tools to unlock other areas that you passed earlier in the game throughout your experience. And they bake that into certain moments in the story, whether it's an upgrade to your weapon or Atreus's weapon, you know, to open those areas.
So what is it about God of War then, and I was also a huge fan of the game, and certainly when it came as like, when all the 10 ratings were coming out, it was one of the few games where I'm such a contrarian normally that like when a game gets 10, I will come up with a list of like why this game is not perfect and all that. It was one of the few games that when it got a 10, I was like, yeah, totally deserves a 10. Like this game is like, I don't like to use the word perfect, but I use the rating scale of a 10 is a game that every human being should experience. It's like, what is my propensity to want to recommend this game? If it's, you know, you might have a really good horror game and I wouldn't give it a 10 because I'd say, oh, this is an 8 because everyone who's a fan of the genre should play it, but not everyone should play this game. For me, God of War, everyone should play that game. But what is it about the game, you know, now that you're playing it again, that makes it so good?
It's interesting. I don't know if it's fair to actually use God of War as a comparison here with talking about open world games. I only segued towards open world because there are elements in it that, you know, kind of made me realize how refreshing of an experience it was. So it's pacing. Having the game on rails in certain areas allows the developers to really control the pacing between action sequences, between enemy encounters, between kind of like story beats and character development, but then also giving it this area where you have almost like a downtime where you're just chilling in a boat with a talking head and boy, you know, missioning around from place to place and kind of discovering a bit more of the lore. I'm finding myself actually reading all those like lore pieces that I didn't read before, because it's really like engrossing me in the story. So when I say that game's a 10, I think you know, breaking it down into its different parts of, you know, graphically it's hitting the marks. Story and pacing is like a huge thing, really, because that's where the player experience will feel either boredom or fatigue or like this is feeling a bit too stale. Progression as well, just the fact that you're constantly adding to your kit, so like combat is always changing and progressing, you're always unlocking new ways of engaging with enemy encounters and being creative. And then at a point where you think it starts to feel stale, you know, you get a new weapon and that changes the gameplay as well. I didn't say which one it was. You know, Kratos has a bunch apparently. And yeah, for me, that's it really. One thing I really, really enjoyed about Spider-Man was the fact that the story beats and the pacing really kept you moving, and the fact that you're constantly adding to your arsenal, constantly upgrading and adding things to your arsenal, to your kit, to make combat like more engaging, and you're always playing around and trying new things, and like that really got me through the game from start to finish. But at the point where it became ticking off boxes, then it felt like a chore, and then I put the game down.
So I think the main storyline has to kind of pull you through. You've got to be able to reason to keep playing. And you know, if I use Days Gone for example, it's one of those games where it's fun enough, but the only thing that's going to keep me going is if it's got an engaging storyline. And you know, while you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that the travel between certain areas, I think that's key as well to the fun factor. So I go, Spider-Man, just swinging around and doing tricks was fun. Being Batman was fun. GTA had, you know, the music that you were playing in your car, and you're switching between channels on the some of those talk radio shows were hilarious. I love them. Laszlo and his like self-help channel or whatever, like that was all great. And
riding a horse.
Yeah.
Not as fun.
Then you go like riding a horse or Assassin's Creed, like riding a horse or a camel. It's in the desert. Like, what could be less fun?
I mean, in Assassin's Creed, you could at least like fast travel everywhere and anywhere.
Only once you discovered an area.
Yeah, once you discovered it.
Like, camel it there the first time.
But with Red Dead, it was a case of, I'm like, cool, I'm going to push through some more of the story today, make some headway, make some progress on that fucking progress bar.
Yeah.
You know, and I put my marker, start riding my horse. Then I'll go, like, stick on the kettle, like, start making a sandwich. And, you know, then maybe I get ambushed on the way, and maybe I kill someone.
Yeah.
And now I'm in trouble. So, like, for me, a lot of that game was like, okay, how much game did I play compared to how much horse did I ride? You know, I'm pretty sure they're sitting on like even markers there.
So then I guess it begs the question, at what point, especially with games who are trying to be realistic, do you get to the point of going, there are a lot of chores in real life.
There are.
But do I play games for the realistic, you know, experience of online chores? Because I mean, that was always the thing that I struggled with MMOs, because it felt like you needed to have like a second career.
Totally.
Because you go into 100%. World of Warcraft or whatever, and you decide to be a hunter, you got to spend time legitimately just hunting animals to get, you know, whatever quilts and what I mean, yeah, skins and that, and pelts and that, just so you can sell them to get gold. It's like, come on, I just want to play a game.
Yeah, and I mean, coming back to Red Dead now, speaking of chores, like there were chores that you could do in your kind of base camp area, you know, take hay bales to the horses, you know, take water, fill up the horse's water bowl, you know, pick up the like pig shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did a couple of them like here and there when I was, you know, when I wanted to like really engross myself in, you know, waking up in the morning, shining my shoes and, you know,
yeah, but they didn't even turn them into mini games. It was just legitimately massive.
Yeah, just do some chores. Yeah. Like, I wonder how many people did all the chores. Like, who's that kind of guy? It's like, you know, I don't leave no hay bales lying around my campsite out here.
I make my bed every morning. What? Yeah, anyway. So I guess there's that escapism, you know, in the need for games to be fun. And where I've seen it, for example, is with games going like, oh, we should make this game VR and we should make this like hand gesture motional. People go, cool, that's great that you can play Skyrim in VR and, you know, you can use hand gestures to control certain games, but you go, at some point I just want to sit on my couch and look at a screen and use a controller, which is actually more convenient than waving my hands around or having to legitimately jump over those hay bales.
Yeah, that's why I think like the Skyrim VR experience never really, I couldn't imagine spending like 100 plus hours in VR. Like, can you even?
And it would be even slower, to be honest, because those 100 hours you played in Skyrim vanilla were because you had a controller, and so you could do all the buttons. If you have to legitimately hack and swing and dodge and all that with your hands, it's just going to be so much, A, more tiring, but just like mental fatigue.
Yeah.
Because everything is a legitimate chore.
So, I mean, look, I think there's still a lot of open world games that are going to be coming our way. This year and next year as well. CD Projekt's big release, Cyberpunk is already slated to be 4 times larger than The Witcher 3. We know they've added like verticality to the world as well, rendering whole cities with crowds of people. we know that they do open worlds well.
Yeah.
But when we compare, let's say, safely, like a 2020 release of Cyberpunk to like a 2020 Assassin's Creed, you know, insert name here. Yeah. I'd probably be gravitating more towards a company who has a track record of creating worlds I feel lived in that I want to explore and be involved in, rather than one that I feel I'm just kind of like hitting my face against.
Yeah. I think, you know, you're bringing up a point there about how certain developers obviously have a knack for open worlds, but also certain genres lead themselves to open worlds. Like, I want to play an open world RPG. I also don't mind playing an open world FPS or looter shooter, that sort of stuff. I don't want to play an open world RTS. I don't want to play an open world like puzzle game, you know? Yeah. But it feels like people go like, oh, well, geez, you've got to have open world. It's almost like the older Battle Royale type thing. It's like, cool, well, we've got an RTS game, and so we're going to have to turn it into a Battle Royale because that's what everybody wants. So it's like, we want a Battle Royale MOBA. We want a Battle Royale shooter. Like, everything's Battle Royale Tetris, for fuck's sake.
So, oh, jeez.
Like, you know what I mean? So it's like, everything needs to be Battle Royale. And so it's like, because that's what people want. They want the 100 man enter, one man leave sort of thing. And so it feels like open world as well. It's this thing of like going, we've got to find a way to make StarCraft open world.
Yeah.
It's like,
Dragon Age 4 is gonna be open world.
But those are RPGs. They do lend
themselves. Those are RPGs. And RPGs, yes, you're right. They do lend themselves to, because, you know, parts of that world are places where you can send your player to upgrade themselves and change themselves in some way.
Okay.
The biggest, I guess, the biggest attraction to an open world RPG is being able to customize your character and see him grow from point A to point B, right?
Yeah.
You know, through, you know, different weapon sets or different ability layouts.
Yeah. Now look, don't get me wrong, I am a fan of open worlds. I think to summarize a little bit, is it doesn't feel like everything needs to be an open world.
Yeah.
There are some that are relevant. I feel the world itself needs to be fun to traverse in. Just being Batman or Spider-Man or driving a car in GTA needs to be fun, so that it doesn't feel like, oh, it's another chore driving to the next mission. Because this comes from previous games in, you know, previous genres where mission one, then mission two, then mission three. Then give me a choice between doing mission five or 5A or whatever. But like, you just started the mission and you didn't have to travel between the damn mission starts and all that.
Yeah.
Especially the classic open world breaking thing where going, you have left the mission area, return immediately.
God.
Like, what's like, what if I don't want to finish this mission right now? You know, like, I think the world needs to be alive. You need to feel like this world exists without you. So if you decide that today I just want to, whatever, sleep in, hit the gym, watch TV, the world goes on without you. I think the main story needs to be urgent and sometimes pull you out of open world mode into on the rails because this shit is urgent. And then I think as limited padding as possible.
Yeah, less busy work and more meaningful consequences and 100%. Choices. Yeah.
And in that case, like, if those kind of rule sets, if that's like the Tim and Gareth rules for making open world are followed, I think you're generally onto a good wicket.
Totally.
There's no padding, there's none of the bad stuff. You're focusing on the good stuff that makes an open world add value rather than just being a need to have because the kids all want open world.
Like, some people might listen to this podcast and think, oh, Tim Lester's like over open world games. And I'm really not, because I'm the kind of player who's played Witcher 3 times and, you know, will happily put it back in my PlayStation and play another 3 times, you know? Like, that's a world I want to carry on being in.
Yeah.
And if your world can do that to me, then I'll buy the game and I'll play it.
Yeah, 100%. I think one last thing with open worlds is they can sometimes be quite daunting when you start and you go, oh my word, there's just so much to do. And then you kind of feel like disengaged because you almost get the same sort of fatigue you have in the real world where you're going, oh my word, there's just so much work to be done or things that I need to do to just like adult. That like, I don't need that again in my real world. That being said, thanks very much to those of you listening in on the podcast. Thanks for the comments and that all on social. You can hit me up on @TheGarethWoods either on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Tim is Tim and a Fish.
Yeah, bro.
On all the platforms.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm on the fence about my Instagram, but I'll probably just go back to Tim and a Fish, whatever.
And so you can check us out on Spotify, iTunes, Pocket Casts, Iona FM, or on Podbean where this podcast is hosted. So if there's a more convenient way for you to listen, you can find it there. Thanks for those who are sharing the podcast. Really do appreciate it. And until next time, damn it, we didn't come up with an outro. Okay, well, we promise by the next podcast there will be an outro.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers.
Yeah, well, some sort of jingle. You got a keyboard there? Let's write a jingle.
All right.
Cheers, guys.
Ciao.
The Gaming Guru Podcast. Easy, the best gaming podcast in the world.